It's good to be together this morning. I know many of you have family plans this weekend, and just grateful to be together with our spiritual family today, to remember the Lord who was born into this world and who died for us and who rose again and who gives us all hope, that brings us together and unites us and encourages us. This morning I want to talk about the story of Esther. And if you'd like to, you can open your Bibles to the book of Esther. We're going to be looking at some highlighted verses in just a little bit as we go through the story. And then we will draw some conclusions as we get to the end of it. But the book of Esther is a very interesting book. And one of the reasons why Esther is such an interesting book is because it is a book in your Bible that doesn't mention God at all. And that's a fact that has caused some people over the years to question whether it even belongs in the Bible. But there's no mention of God. His name is never named. There's no Yahweh. There's no Elohim. There's no El Shaddai. There's none of those terms that are used to refer to the name of God. But despite that, God's fingerprints are all over this story. And I think that as we go through it, you'll see that this story can only be explained by the unseen hand of God working dramatically and powerfully. The book of Esther is, in our English Bibles, the last book of history in the Old Testament. It is right before the books of wisdom literature and then the prophets. So as you go through your Old Testament Bibles, you'll see that they end with Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and then transition into Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. And then you have the four major prophets and the 12 minor prophets. And the reason why it comes right at the end is because this story is set right at the end of Israel's history, as we have it in the Old Testament. It's set in the time period after the exile. And if you look at the opening verses, we get a little insight into what's going on. So in Esther chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. So, as you probably recall, Israel was taken captive by Babylon. But Babylon was taken over by the Persians, and you can read about that in the book of Daniel. Remember that Daniel has interactions with Nebuchadnezzar, but then he ends up having further interactions with Persian kings. And if you remember from Israelite history, it was the Persian king Cyrus who issued the decree for Israel to leave Babylon, to return home, and to rebuild the temple. And you can read about that in Ezra chapter 1. But there were many Jews who stayed behind in Babylon after the Persians took over. And as they lived in Babylon, they began to live under the Persian Empire. And this Ahasuerus that we just read about at the beginning of Esther is the Hebrew name for this Persian king, but in secular history, he's better known by his Greek name, which is Xerxes. And Xerxes is famous in secular history for his massive losses to Leonidas and the 300 Spartans at the Battle of Thermopylae. Same guy. That's depicted in different records of that. But that battle happened in 480 BC. And so this story of Esther begins in the third year of his reign, which would be about 2 years before that, in 482 BC. And another interesting tidbit that helps us to place this story is that if we know that it's during the reign of Xerxes or Ahasuerus, that would put all of these events between Ezra chapter 6 and Ezra chapter 7, which is between the reigns of Darius and Artaxerxes, who is Xerxes' son. But the story of Esther is a thrilling story. It's dramatic, it's full of reversals, it is a very exciting story And so I'm going to start just by giving you an overview of it. So as we've seen in chapter 1 sets the story in motion. And it's during this 180-day feast that Xerxes gets drunk, and he decides that he wants his wife, Queen Vashti, to parade herself before his friends. And in verse 11, he commands his servants to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this time, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. And so, because Queen Vashti refuses, King Xerxes decides he needs a new queen. And so he gets rid of Vashti, and the way that he decides to go about finding a new queen is to host a beauty pageant. And you can read about that in chapter 2. If you look in chapter 2, in verse 1, it says, "After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, 'Let beautiful young virgins be brought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa the citadel, under custody of Hegai the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti.' This pleased the king, and he did so." So women from all over the vast kingdom of Persia are brought together to this capital city of Susa, and the king is on the search to see who his new bachelorette queen will be. But then we're introduced to Mordecai and Esther. If you look in verse 5, it says, "Now there was a Jew in Susa the citadel whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at, and when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa the citadel in custody of Hegai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Hegai, who had charge of the women." And so we see that Mordecai and Esther find themselves here mixed up in what's going on with Xerxes and the search for the new queen. Esther ends up in this contest, one of the candidates to be the queen. And lo and behold, Esther is the one that is chosen. You see down in verse 16 that it says, "When Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti." So that gets the story in motion, and now we have Esther in place as the new queen. But then chapter 3 introduces us to the third main character in the story. We have Mordecai, we have Esther, but now in chapter 3, we're introduced to Haman. And if you look in chapter 3 in verse 1, it tells us that after these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were before him. Now, there's a few things that are interesting about Haman, and he will show us how interesting he is as the story goes on. But one thing we notice right away is that it tells us that Haman was an Agagite. That's sort of a strange thing to say about him. And that means he is a descendant of Agag. Now, this is like, you know, Bible bonus points. If you can remember this, then you get a gold star for today. But if you know who King Agag is, then you know who Haman is descended from. Agag was the king of the Amalekites, who Saul was supposed to put to death back in 1 Samuel chapter 15. And remember that this was the reason why Saul lost his kingship. It was taken from him because he failed to obey God and put King Agag to death. Now, if Saul had obeyed God 550 years earlier, there would have been no Haman to deal with in Esther chapter 3. But he didn't, and so here he is. But here's an interesting thing, too. Is if you remember when Mordecai was introduced to us in chapter 2 in verse 5, it tells us that Mordecai is a son of Kish, a Benjamite. Do you remember that that was also true of King Saul? Saul was the son of Kish, and Saul was a Benjamite. And here's where we can begin to see how even Jesus can be seen in this story. Because where this first son of Kish failed, we see that this son of Kish, Mordecai, will succeed. He will overcome the Agagite, even though Saul did not. Now, if you look at what happens with Haman, look in verse 2 of chapter 3. It says, "And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, 'Why do you transgress the king's command?' And when they spoke to him day after day and he would not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone. So as they had made known to him the people of Mordecai, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus." And so now here is the main source of conflict in the story. Haman is in this high position, and there's this decree that everybody has to bow down and pay homage to him, but Mordecai dares to resist that declaration. And Haman gets really upset about it. And it's not enough for Haman to just get rid of Mordecai. Haman wants to get rid of all of Mordecai's people, wipe out the Jews, exterminate them completely. And so he sets his mind to do that here. Now, in verse 13, it tells us that letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. A copy of the document was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to all the peoples to be ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly by order of the king, and the decree was issued in Susa, the citadel, and the king and Haman sat down to drink. But the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. And so now, Haman's intentions have become law. He's gone to the king. He's had this decree issued. It's been sent out. The date is set. The doom of the Jews is in motion. Now, as you might expect as we get into chapter 4, when the Jews find out about this, they are devastated. It spells the end of them as a people. It means that all of them are facing death. Mordecai is the first one that we read about here in chapter 4. And in verse 1, Mordecai learns that all has been done, and he tears his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, went out into the midst of the city, and cried out with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one was allowed to enter the king's gate clothed in sackcloth. And then in verse 3, it tells us, "And in every province, wherever the king's command and his decree reached, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting, and many of them lay in sackcloth and ashes." And in verse 4, when Esther's young women and her eunuchs came and told her, the queen was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. And so everybody is understandably upset, because it looks like extinction is coming to the Jews, and there's nothing that can be done about it. Haman has had his way, and he will get rid of them all. And all of this leads to the most dramatic conversation of the book. If you go down to chapter 4 in verse 11, Esther is explaining to the king's servant that she can't just go to the king. That's just not something that you do. That would be a very dangerous thing. She says in chapter 4 in verse 11, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner courts without being called, there is but one law to be put to death, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter so that he may live. But as for me, I have not been called to come into the king these 30 days. But then in verse 12, they told Mordecai what Esther had said. And in verse 13, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, "Do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered him. There's a lot to be impressed with in this portion of the story. I'm impressed, first of all, with Mordecai's reasoning to Esther. You know, he says, "Look, I know that God doesn't depend on us. If you don't do the thing that you really ought to do, God will find another way. God will do what he needs to do to take care of his people and honor his promises." You see, Mordecai knew that God had promised that he would restore the people of Israel. Mordecai knew that God had promised that he would bring the Messiah through the people of Israel. It wasn't possible that God would let them be totally exterminated. But Mordecai says, if you can play a part in accomplishing God's will, then you need to do it. And I'm also impressed with Esther's bravery. You know, she hears what Mordecai says to her. She considers his words. And ultimately, in verse 16, she decides, you know what, this is the right thing to do, no matter what the consequences are. If it goes terribly, it goes terribly. If he doesn't hold out his golden scepter, he doesn't hold out his golden scepter. If I die, I die. But I'll do what I need to do. Well, in chapter 5, Esther makes good on her word. She goes before the king, and he holds out his golden scepter. And she has this conversation with him where he says, "Well, what is it that you want? Why have you come before me?" And Esther says, very tactfully, "I'd like to have a feast. I'd like for you to come to this feast. And I'd like Haman to come to this feast also." And so the king agrees, and they decide to come to the feast. And they come to the feast, and he asks her again, "Well, what is it that you want, Esther?" And she says, "I'd like you to come to a second feast." And so she has a second feast for the king and for Haman to come back to again. But meanwhile, we learn in chapter 5 that Haman is doing some things behind the scenes. And Haman has prepared a gallows 75 feet high, which he plans to have Mordecai hung on. That's his plan for Mordecai. Well, that leads us to chapter 6. And it's in chapter 6 where we see the king can't sleep. He's laying in bed at night, and he's tossing and turning, and so he decides to start reading some books. And the books that he reads are books of history, things that have happened during the course of his reign as king of Persia. And one of the things that he reads about is this nondescript Jewish guy who saved him from a plot against his life. Two of his servants wanted to have him put to death, and Mordecai had learned about it and had exposed the plot and saved his life. And so that leads King Xerxes to decide that this Mordecai needs to be honored. And right as he's thinking about all of this, Haman is the one who walks into his chamber. In chapter 6, in verse 4, it says, "The king said, 'Who is in the court?' Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in the court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman said to himself, well, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set, and let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor. Let them lead him on the horse through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then the king said to Haman, hurry, take the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so to Mordecai, the Jew, who sits at the king's gate. Leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. This is the first of many reversals that happens as this story begins to be concluded. And this is where Mordecai's plans start to crash down on him. I would just have loved to have seen Mordecai's face in this moment, you know? I mean, Haman. I'm saying Mordecai, I mean Haman. I hope you know that. I would have loved to have seen Haman's face in this moment. As he comes before the king and he says, King, the king says, what should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And Haman has this grand plan and he says, this is going to be great. You should do all of this. And when the king says, yes, do that to Mordecai, I mean, he would have just been so deflated. And he was the one who had the honor of leading this parade through the streets and saying, this is what happens to the one who the king wants to honor. And so he goes home, and he complains to his wife, and he's very low. But in chapter 7, we see that Esther prepares the second feast. And it's here that Xerxes and Haman show up to the second feast. And the king asks Esther again, what is it that you want? What is it that you're asking me to do for you? And in verse 3, this is where Esther begins to reveal what's going on. In verse 3, Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king. Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, who is he, and where is he, who has dared to do this? And Esther said, a foe and enemy, this wicked Haman. Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. So Esther reveals that this is actually what the problem is, that there's one who is planning to destroy all the people, and he's actually planning to destroy my people because I am of the people planning to be destroyed. And the king says, who is the wicked, evil person that would do this? And she says, it's Haman. He's the one. Now in verse 7, the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king said, will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my own house? As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house 50 cubits high. And the king said, hang him on that. So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated. So, not only does Mordecai get the honor that Haman thought that he was going to get, but Haman gets the death that he thought that Mordecai was going to get. It's a great reverse. And again, I just love the poetic justice in this story. I love the drama of it. You know, there's this great reveal where the king realizes that Haman is the one plotting this evil. And as Haman is falling on this couch, begging for his life, the king walks back in and sees this man laying on a couch alone with his wife. And he says, like, the gall, the boldness. And that is the death knell for Haman. Now, we start to see some resolution in chapter 8. Because it's in chapter 8 where Esther pleads with the king to reverse Haman's decree. Now that Haman is out of the way, we need to make a reversal of the decree that's been mentioned so that the Jews can be saved. The problem is that under the law of the Medes and the Persians, you can't just reverse a decree. You can't undo a law that has been written. And so the next best thing you can do is you can make a new law. And so the king agrees to let Esther make a new law that will be in place in addition to the law that's already in place. And so the new decree gives the Jews permission to fight back against any who would attack them. And I think the idea was that if there's a law in place that says the Jews can fight back, it would discourage anybody from trying to exterminate them in the first place. But that's not exactly how it plays out. But this is a great victory. And Mordecai leaves the presence of the king in royal robes with a great golden crown on his head. And there was gladness and there was joy among the Jews. In chapter 9, you see some of that in verse 1. Where it says, in the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, on the 13th day of the same, when the king's command and edict were about to be carried out, on the very day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, the reverse occurred. The Jews gained mastery over those who hated them. The Jews gathered in their cities throughout all the provinces of King Ahasuerus to lay hands on those who sought their harm, and no one could stand against them, for the fear of them had fallen on all peoples. All the officials of the provinces and the satraps and the governors and the royal agents also helped the Jews, for the fear of Mordecai had fallen on them. For Mordecai was great in the king's house. And his fame spread throughout all the provinces, for the man Mordecai grew more and more powerful. The Jews struck all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did as they pleased to those who hated them. And so, what we see is that with this new decree, that those who hoped to have mastery over the Jews ended up being mastered by them. And in verse 1, we have the phrase that the reverse occurred. And that really is the theme of this whole book of Esther, is it's never what you expect. It is the reverse that occurs. And the Jews are able to defend themselves and overcome those who would oppress them. Now, the last major event in this story is the beginning of a new holiday. After all of this has happened and the Jews have been delivered and this certain disaster has been averted, look at what happens in verse 20. It says, and Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar, and also the 15th day of the same year by year, as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness, and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another, and gifts to the poor. So the people come up with this annual holiday that's characterized by getting together and eating good food and exchanging gifts. Sounds like a good idea to me. And we find out in verse 26 that this holiday is called Purim. And that comes after the term pur, which is the Persian word for lots. Back in chapter 3, when Haman was deciding what day to plan the extermination of the Jews on, he cast lots. In chapter 3 and verse 7, it says they cast pure. That is, they cast lots. And so this feast is now called Purim in remembrance of how this disaster was averted. Now, what I find interesting about this holiday is that it wasn't a holiday that the Lord had instructed them to keep. God had given the people of Israel many holidays in the Old Law. Back in Exodus chapter 12, it was God who came up with Passover, and he told them, I want you to remember this every year so that you remember the deliverance that you've gotten from this Egyptian slavery. But as you read about the origin of Purim here in the book of Esther, you see that this is not a holiday that God had given them directly. In fact, it was something that started organically among the Jews who lived out in the villages, in the rural places, that they, on their own, decided, we would like to remember this annually. And so they start to practice this. And despite this being a man-made tradition, we see that it's not condemned by God. And it was continued to be celebrated throughout Israel's history. It was celebrated during the return from captivity, during the intertestamental period, on into the first century. It was never condemned by God or by Jesus or by the prophets or the apostles. And in fact, this would have been one of the days that Paul would have had in mind when he wrote Romans 14, saying that some people keep the day and some people don't. So I'll just go ahead and make the parallel. It doesn't sound too different to me than some people deciding to celebrate Christmas and some people not. It doesn't make any difference to me one way or the other whether you do, and I don't think it makes any difference to God either. And as Bob has already mentioned today, there is one remembrance and one feast that God has told us to remember, and we've done that today as we've eaten the Lord's Supper in remembrance of the death and resurrection of Christ. But this is a feast that the people come up with. It's one that they voluntarily celebrate to remember what God has done for them. Now, as we've seen this story play out, I want you to see that Esther tells the story of God's people being delivered from their physical enemies. But the thing that I want to leave you with is seeing how the gospel tells the story of God's people being delivered from our spiritual enemies. And I believe that there are many ways that the book of Esther prefigures the gospel itself. And so to conclude, I'd like to consider how Esther, or how Christ, can be seen in Esther, Mordecai, and even Haman in this story. Let's think about Esther for just a moment. Esther was this nondescript orphan. The king looked far and wide to find the most exceptional woman that he could find to be the queen. And he ended up choosing the lowly Jewish girl down the street. Jesus was a lowly Jewish boy from Nazareth. Isaiah 53 tells us that he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was somebody that nobody would have thought very much of, came from very humble beginnings. But despite their humble beginnings, both Esther and Jesus were put in a position to save their people. And in order to do that, both of them had to be willing to face the wrath of the king. In Esther chapter 4, in verse 14, remember that Mordecai asked Esther, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? And Esther replied in verse 16, if I perish, I perish. But it was Jesus who said in John chapter 12 and verse 27, now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose I have come to this hour. See, Esther knew that she might die to save her people. Jesus came to this earth knowing that he would. But now, what about Mordecai? Mordecai was the target of Haman, but Haman's gallows actually became his own downfall, and it was Mordecai who was exalted. Isn't it true that Christ used Satan's weapons against him as well? The cross, which surely was designed by Satan to be the downfall of Christ, became Satan's own downfall. 1 Corinthians 2, verses 7 and 8. Paul says, "But we impart a secret and hidden wisdom of God, which God decreed before the ages for our glory. None of the rulers of this age understood this, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." Colossians 2, in verse 15, Paul makes the statement that he disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in it, which is a reference to the cross. As much as I would have liked to have seen Haman's face when he realized that he was going to be hung on his own gallows, I would have liked to have seen Satan's face too, when he realized that the death of Jesus was not his defeat, not Jesus' defeat, but his own. And on the subject of Haman's death was shameful. You know, there are most translations that say in the book of Esther that he built gallows, and that usually makes us think of like the Old West style gallows, like big tall poles with like nooses hanging down, and that's not the idea. Most likely, this was something that was like a big pole. Literally, in Hebrew, the word is tree. The word is tree. It was probably a sharpened pole that the victim would be impaled on. And so Haman was hanged on a tree. It's the same language that Paul uses in Galatians 3 to describe the death of Christ. In verse 13, he tells us, "Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree,' so that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith." You see, the pain and humiliation that Haman experienced should make us appreciate the pain and humiliation that Christ experienced for us. He was hanged on a tree. We deserved to die like Haman, but Jesus died for us instead. He redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. And so, as I've said, the book of Esther is a story of reversals. But the gospel is a story of reversals too. And the same God who worked out the first story for the nation of Israel has worked out the second story for all of humanity. The Son of God was born as a lowly carpenter's son. He gave his life to save his people who were condemned to die. And now he reigns over all of his enemies, crowned with glory and honor as the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And so as we see this ancient story of Esther play out, we can see Christ in Esther, we can see Christ in Mordecai, and we can see Christ in Haman. And in all three places, we can rejoice that we have such a Savior. There might be somebody here who needs to think about your relationship with the Lord. And what the book of Esther also reminds us of is that God is eager to rescue and save his people. You might be somebody that is condemned to die because you've been living in sin. You might have been doing things that you have known are wrong for a very long time. You might not yet have decided to become a Christian. But there is forgiveness, there's grace, there's salvation freely offered to anybody who will accept the Lord. You might need to repent of something in your life and be faithful to the Lord once again. There might be something that you want to confess or ask for prayers about. And if we can help you in any way, we want you to know that you have an opportunity to make your life right with God before you leave. But we have a wonderful Savior. We have a God who wants to rescue us from the wrath to come. And if you want to come to him with a humble and obedient heart, come to the front and let us know how we can help while we stand together and sing the song together.